It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
My name is Shimon. I think my biography that's relevant is, you know, I became a revolutionary right after 9/11, more or less. Since then, I've floated in the anarchy, ultra-left, communist world. You know, I consider myself, in addition to that, a Fanonist, and I've been involved in a bunch of other stuff. And, you know, now I'm here after the George Floyd uprising, you know, talking to It's Going Down.
My name is Arturo. I'm a substitute teacher in Philadelphia. Originally from Spain, I have connections to the anarchist movement there, especially in Barcelona. I've been involved in militant struggles against the police, gentrification, and imperialism since about 2005.
Well, thank you both for taking the time to come on, and you all have been writing a lot, and it's great to have some of your writings up on It's Going Down, but also just to have the time to talk with you all about them and some of the ideas that have been brought up by them, which have been really great and critical. And I feel like asking a lot of really interesting questions. And you all have obviously written a lot about the recent rebellion. I'm just curious, what would you say are some of the major takeaways that your work has touched on about this moment?
The first and most important one is the huge tactical leap and innovation that was made with the burning of the Third Precinct. I mean, you know, there's all kinds of rumors to this day of that it was done by white supremacists and it was really the job of outside agitators. I imagine the listeners who listen to IGD will know that that is just nonsense. It was an immense accomplishment of the proletariat, creating a new political landscape of how Arturo and I have described as revolutionary abolition, which stands firmly against the more reformist abolition that has kind of become the popular thing of lots of, I think, well-intentioned people. But I would argue that revolutionary abolition became a force with the burning of that precinct down. And that's maybe, for me, one of the biggest takeaways of last year's uprising. Arturo.
Going off that, but a slightly different point, is that we saw that the police can be defeated in the streets. All over the country, police departments were completely helpless to stop the rebellions, for up to a week at a time, and they had to call in the National Guard in order to actually put an end to the riots and the looting. So this potential for, revolutionary abolitionism is very real, we really want people to take that seriously, that kind of revolutionary potential is there, and the proletariat isn't just some pitiful, vulnerable, weak mass of people, but, took advantage of the pandemic, took advantage of the immense crisis that was taking place in this country in order to wage a very serious assault on not only the police state, but also the capitalist class, looting.
Yeah, and maybe one last, takeaway. I mean, there's so many takeaways from this uprising. It was such a transformative event. One of the takeaways is it came from this text that was written. I forget the name, but you can get it from Ill Will, called Imaginary Enemies. And it's one of my favorite lines of the uprising. I think about it basically every day because I think it reveals the deep division that in exists between what I think Arturo and I might call the George Floyd left and the non-George Floyd left. I know that's an awkward framing, but here's this one sentence that captures last summer's tension. It says, "It's one thing to hold a sign, says redistribute the wealth. It is another to decide that all that on the store shelves is ours for the taking and take it, right? That to me encapsulates the difference between people who hold signs saying defund, abolish this, have a better world, this, blah, 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 versus the proletarians who went out and did it, right? And if we can capture that division and then expand on it and make it a part of the actual developing George Floyd partisans or comrades, whatever we want to call them, I think we'll be entering a new phase of class struggle in the United States.
Well, with that in mind, I'm curious, what makes this round of riots and rebellions different than others in the past, say in the 1960s or the LA Rebellion, for instance?
Black proletarians have been, you know, obviously fighting the police state and having rebellions, you know, for a long time, at least since the 60s, even before that. And there have been, like, accomplices that have gone along with that. But I think we would argue that compared to what happened last summer, more non-black people took part in the insurgent activities that were initiated by the black proletariat, but, you know, which all these different groups joined in. And that has happened to a degree that is unprecedented, at least, you know, since the 60s.
That's right. And one other thing I'd just add is the context of the rebellion is very different. In the 60s, right, the 67, 68, the big wave of riots, and the earlier ones, obviously, that Arturo alludes to, happened in the context of national liberation struggles. So there's a huge effort to kind of make sense of them within that paradigm. But today, you know, there are no national the context of national liberation struggles is over. And so it's a different international context that we find not only the uprisings happening here, but around the world occurring. And it creates for a different set of politics, right? We find the world is struggling against police violence. The world is struggling against the pandemic. The world is struggling against inequality. And then obviously just failed governance around the capitalist system. So the terrain of how this, the riots, the uprising is taking place is rather different.
There's also, you know, since the 70s, there's been growing immiseration of like working class people. Deindustrialization has happened. There's been the rise of the service retail economy, you know, and most working class people having these jobs with very little job security that are oftentimes seasonal and temporary. We think all of that has created this terrain in which you see more different racialized groups besides just mostly black people engaging in the riots. So there's this changing composition of capitalism and the proletariat that we saw express itself last year in the riots.
And, you know, one other thing on that point, I think you all stated this in a different interview, but, I mean, if you look at the amount of riots that happened, you know, between, say, the start of the George Floyd uprising in late May of last year up until now, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the amount of them is even greater than, say, like, you know, a three-year period, you know, quote, in the 60s, which is late 60s to, you know, early 70s or something like that. It seems like there was more incidents of like physical rioting, like, you know, clashes with the police, people in the streets, looting, property destruction, all that, that happened, in this like couple month period than there was in like several years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That sounds right.
And the other difference is what's interesting is, right, the riots, to speak to your point, reflected the changing terrain of cities themselves. Lots of the riots were like, you know, a good chunk of the riots were like, yeah, we're not going to, I mean, some of them rioted in the so-called, you know, their own neighborhood, but a lot of them went to the wealthiest areas, the Magnificent Mile, Soho in New York City, right, so on and so on, and said, we'll loot what, you know, we'll loot the Gucci store, the Versace store, X, Y, and Z, the Nike store, all that kind of stuff. So lots of people have asked, oh, were the riots have anything to do with class? And it's just astonishing to me to look at where some of the rioting, a significant part of the rioting took place, which was, you know, the rioters clearly knew where the wealth was. And they said, all right, let's go take this wealth. So it blows my mind that people think the riots had no class content.
And that's a big difference from the 60s, too, right? Attack storming the centers of, you know, power of capitalist commerce instead of it being mostly focused in working class neighborhoods.
Yeah. I mean, even in the terms of working class neighborhoods, I don't know if you all saw, that short Vice documentary they did about, fireworks in New York, during the uprising. But essentially the kind of narrative they developed at the end was like people as part of the rebellion were going off and shooting off fireworks like all throughout the night, because it was like part of the revolt. They were taking back the streets, either clashing with the cops or just, staying up partying, because this was like an extension of the rebellion. So I don't know. There was all these kind of different things that played a part in it, even if people weren't like going out and looting or fighting with the cops.
Absolutely. So it's hilarious. I mean, I agree with that. Lots of people were like, this is a psyop operation by, mysterious forces of the state to disturb proletarian communities. And I found those arguments to be just plain ridiculous. The simple argument.
They talk about that, and like the people that were like, doing the fireworks just like laughed at that and said, no, this is like, look at what's happening. Like, we're in the middle of history being made.
I think it's just, it's worth commenting. It's a symptom of, I think, something extraordinary happened. And what's amazing is, like, proletarians did it, and lots of middle-class people just can't, and middle-class activists just can't grapple with the extraordinary event that happened. So they invent, in many ways, it's like the conspiracy theories around Trump and stuff. They invent these fabulous stories that are just unnecessary. And so, I'm like, sometimes the simplest explanation is the right explanation. There's lots of cheap fireworks. 4th of July didn't happen. The big fireworks that happened. So kids went out and bought cheap fireworks. Like, I don't see why, and it was an extension of the rebellion. That's exactly right. So I don't see why the simplest explanation isn't the most obvious, it isn't the most obvious explanation. And it kind of boggles my mind that we have to invent these fantastic arguments that really have nothing to do with what the proletariat is doing. It shows how disconnected intellectually, physically, emotionally, lots of people are from the proletariat.
Well, also, it just shows their own internal biases, because it's all based around the idea that everyday people are stupid and that they are tricked into launching some nationwide rebellion because, some guy in a gas mask, broke a window on an auto repair store.
Right.
And it's like, oh,
AutoZone man.
He tricked us. Man. Well, let's turn now. What's the significance of the rebellion happening during the pandemic? How does this impact what happened or inform it?
I mean, Shimon can probably talk about this more because he's been working on it more. But, we really think about the book Black Jacobins by C.L.R. James and the way he talks about yellow fever during the Haitian Revolution and the way that slaves were able to take advantage of that. In order to fight the French military. And, it's not exactly the same, but there is an interaction. It's not completely by coincidence that this uprising happened as a pandemic is happening. And, we think people, in a way took advantage of the crisis of the pandemic. And, the fact that the state was in a way distracted and very much caught off guard. But, Shimon, I think you could probably talk about this more.
No, that's probably where I'm coming from too. As soon as the pandemic happened, I'm like a single track, revolutionary. I was like, okay, pandemic's happening. That day when the lockdowns finally came, I just bought like tons of books on pandemics, and you can guess it, class struggle and revolution. And in my head, the proletariat has fought against medical authorities, and you could be all over the world for various reasons, because 18th century medicine was pretty awful to lots of proletarians. In fact you're as likely to be killed by a doctor as you're likely to be healed by a doctor for most of human history. So the proletariat is in my head I call it an ancient form of class struggle against these forms of biopolitics, which in my opinion, What really mattered, lots of activists, woke activists, think that they can have some radical position on being against the lockdown or being for the lockdown. And I don't think there's any radical position to have around any of those questions. The only radical position to have is the proletariat must fight, because the capitalist class is bearing and crushing it. It's gotten a lot richer. We know that. And it's using all kinds of emergency powers to shut society down, which should make any serious anti-authoritarian revolutionary pretty damn nervous, because they can use it for the pandemic. I can guarantee you, they used it for the uprising last summer, and they're only going to get better at it the upcoming years as this pandemic teaches them how to shut down all of society. So I'm not advocating pro or anti-lockdown politics. I don't think there's a radical poll to be found in that. What I am advocating is follow the proletariat. And what we see around the world is the proletariat is fighting back. And that, to me, answers the question of all these woke activists who spill thousands of words on, should we be for or against a lockdown? What's the right position? Blah, blah, blah. I'm like, the proletariat answered that question for me last summer. I know that might not be the politically correct thing to say, but the proletariat does not obey the political correctness of the left. It does what it must do. Just observing what happened, I think that's like pretty clear.
In a lot of your work, you talk about the role of counterinsurgency within the rebellion. Is it fair to say that counterinsurgency has been more of a weapon against the revolt than just the violence of the police?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's both, definitely. So I don't know which one is more, you know, successful in containing the riots. It just happens in different ways. But I think in a lot of ways, the political repression more than, you know, the National Guard and the police crackdown and the, you know, like militias and things like that, the political repression is harder to counter in the sense that it comes from within the movement itself. It's internal to the movement. And, you know, it's not something that we can just, outmaneuver in a physical, tactical way. There's political debates that we need to be able to win on the ground in the moment. We need to be able to convince people and win them over to our side. And yeah, that's a lot harder than just outmaneuvering the police or the National Guard, you know, and doing what we got to do to, you know, to take care of business. I don't know. What do you think, Shimon?
No, I think that's absolutely right. Yeah. You know, that, and the only, you know, I would just add, you know, the definitive form of counterinsurgency that occurred was, you know, paradoxically, this was, I still think Arturo and I are correct about thinking of it as a black-led, multiracial, proletarian uprising. But at the same time, you know, if you paid close attention to it, the counterinsurgency was led by black middle-class NGOs and things of that sort. You know, it wasn't white activists in New York City who said, let's kneel down with the cops. It was other black activists who said, let's kneel down with the police. And there were, like, you know, some crazy activists who got up and shouted, no, we're not going to do this, and this is ridiculous, and stopped the crowd from doing it. But that's a battle that, you know, the black proletariat and the black middle class must fight out in the streets. In some ways, the black middle class has won the battle in the temporary moment. That's obvious why the state is behind them. The state gives them money. State isn't putting them in jail for being out in the street with their, you know, silly peaceful protests during the daytime and all that kind of stuff. And so the black proletariat is in a profoundly precarious and in some ways, you know, an isolated position because it tried in some ways, the uprising tried to solve the coordination problem around race in the United States. And for a fleeting moment, it navigated that and how, in some ways, how race politics works in this country. And it's inseparable from counterinsurgency is that each respective middle class wants ownership of their proletariat. So the black middle class is like, the black proletariat is ours. The white middle class, you know, is generally like the white proletariat is ours. Interesting, the liberal middle class doesn't feel that way, right? The liberal middle class calls the white proletariat hillbillies and uneducated. So the right has tried to take up that mantle. And the Asian middle class does the same thing with the Asian proletariat. And so there's basically some kind of like master-serf relationship that these middle classes deploy. And the uprising last semester, obviously, for a small moment, scrambled that, right? That the middle classes could no longer speak and coordinate and be the masters of their respective proletarians. Of course, the counterinsurgency's entire plan is to reform that kind of servile relationship, you know, and create stability and peace and all that kind of stuff. So that contradiction is very, very heavy and something that has yet to be still, you know, battled or finished, completed in class.
I can't breathe! I can't breathe! Play that shit on TNT.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Shimon Arturo,
yeah.
Lee.
Evergreen with the heat, damn.
bystander's cell phone recording Floyd's pleas for precious breath.
Hear me, man.
Capturing those prescient words for those excruciating minutes.
If we don't get no justice, then it ain't gonna be no peace. I'm sick of police killing all our people in the streets. We gonna do this shit for George Floyd. We gonna do this shit for George Floyd. Say, get the hell up off me, I said I can't breathe. Until I see some changes, homie, I can't leave. I'ma do this shit for George Floyd. We gon' do this shit for George Floyd.
Look, 400 years, it's been 400 years since our people saw some freedom, now it's time to interfere. No longer will we sit down and ponder, man, it's time to get our voices heard on every single corner. We done protested in peace, but ain't nobody listen. It's funny how when you get violent, people pay attention. But now we thugs, according to these presidential Twitter rants. While we get murdered, Donald Trump is on vacation fishing. They staring at me when I walk in the suburban stores. When cops pull us over, they don't even know what for. Guess I'm a criminal cause I got on a ball cap. And you smell some weed, so I guess I deserve my skull crack. And if a nigga kill an officer, his life he facing. But if a cop kill a nigga, he get paid vacation. It's crazy how a traffic stop could turn into a murder. But if our voices don't get heard, then we gon' take it further. If we don't get no justice, then it ain't gon' be no peace. I'm sick of police killing all our people in the streets. We gon' do this shit for George Floyd. We gon' do this shit for George Floyd. Say, get the hell up off me, I said I can't breathe. Until I see some changes, homie, I can't leave. I'ma do this shit for George Floyd. We gon' do this shit for George Floyd.
I see Martin Luther's dream still ain't coming true. And we done held these signs for years, there's nothing left to do. But ride and set this bitch on fire, cause we angry as a bitch and plus I'm sick of being quiet. We were socially divided way before Corona. Look at what they did to Rodney King out in California. And look, it's 30 years later, ain't a damn thing changed. But trust me, y'all about to feel his pain. Cause through all this tear gas and bullets that y'all shooting, I hope y'all understand that this is way deeper than looting. No justice, no peace. You can replace all of them stores, my people still deceased. Listen, black lives matter. All lives matter. That's obvious, but who they coming after? Listen, black lives matter. All lives matter. That's obvious, but who they coming after? If we don't get no justice, then it ain't gonna be no peace. I'm sick of police killing all our people in the streets. We gon' do this shit for George Floyd. We gon' do this shit for George Floyd. Say, get the hell up off me, I said I can't breathe. Until I see some changes, homie, I can't leave. I'ma do this shit for George Floyd. We gon' do this shit for George Floyd.
So we've already kind of touched on this a little bit, but I wanted to go back to it. What was the importance of looting during the rebellion? This seems to be one of the most demonized aspects of the revolt, like across the board. But it also seems to be one of the most clear things that the authorities did not want to spread or happen. Seems in some instances they're almost willing to let some property destruction happen or people like be in the streets, but it seems like looting is something they really wanted to crack down on. Just curious your thoughts.
I mean, I think it's like you were saying before, it's expropriation of capitalist wealth, especially in the context of the pandemic, skyrocketing unemployment, you know, all deteriorating standards of life. It makes sense. But also, you know, it is a direct attack on the commodity form. And the idea that, you know, the things that we want can only be bought and sold. But in a tactical sense too, like, I think it's also, you see a lot of looting once a certain area has been, basically taken by the police. People will outmaneuver the police and then they'll start looting in other surrounding areas, or they'll jump in cars and they'll start going throughout the city looting. So I think it's also like a really important tactical response when the street fighting with the police is no longer possible. And I think that's why, you know, we're seeing it more and more, like what happened in Brooklyn Center 2 weeks ago. There was way less street fighting with the cops, but a lot of looting happening all over the place. And I guess the last thing I'll just say is that it corresponds with the current composition of capitalism and the proletariat that we're in right now. You know, people don't have these jobs and big factories, you know, where all these revolutionary forces emerged from in the past. They have retail service jobs, and rebelling against those jobs, you know, it doesn't look so much like taking them over and running them in a new way. A lot of times it looks like destroying those jobs and expropriating the goods that they exist in. And, you know, I'm not going to go into too much information, but like, I know for a fact that people in Philly worked at certain places were also helping to loot those places. And they were part of that process.
Yeah, and I'll just add, you know, for people who want, like, I mean, I think that's absolutely right, who want, like, a really strict definition, right? I think Joshua Clover's done some really important work on this, right? He says, right, strikes are the struggle that set the price of labor, and what are riots? They're struggles to set the price of market goods, right? And when you loot, the price becomes zero, right? So I think, like, it's, I don't know how else, you know, I think Arturo did a great job of explaining the dynamics of looting, but it's clearly an attack on a certain dimension of capitalism, the commodity form, exactly how Arturo said.
So most recently we saw another round of riots and protests across the U.S., specifically in Brooklyn Center outside of Minneapolis, break out after the police murder of Dante Wright. I'm just curious, you know, what does this more recent wave of revolt teach us, both in terms of proletarian self-activity and also the state response? So, for instance, flooding Minnesota with 3,000 National Guard, getting them ready across the U.S., and so on.
You know, it tells us where this is the Dante Wright. I mean, I think we would consider there was an uprising in Brooklyn Center or the metropolitan area of Minneapolis. And what is striking is obviously the preparation of the state. What's striking is trying to think about, is this a brand new cycle of struggle, or is this connected to the George Floyd uprising? And if so, how so? Right? There's that kind of dimension of thinking about the continuity of struggle. Is this part of the kind of developing trend that we saw last summer, where over time, Black proletarians became more isolated? Like by the time of the Walter Wallace Jr. uprising in Philadelphia in the fall, it was, you know, in West Philadelphia, it was basically Black proletarians who are out there in the street. So you do see the racial composition changing. And in Brooklyn Center, it was like, you know, still multiracial, but, you know, some of the most militant kids were probably, you know, were overwhelmingly Black proletarians. So there's clearly some changing terrain, internal to the movement and then external to the movement. I'll stop there because there's more that could be said. Maybe Arturo, if you want to jump off from there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Shimon's point, like, it does seem like the Black proletariat, and we kind of started seeing this in Philadelphia and also in Louisville, you know, just increasingly fights alone is more and more isolated. And the rebellions that are happening seem, at least in terms of the people that are willing to fight and loot and riot, it's just mostly just Black people that are doing that now. And I mean, another thing, is, like you mentioned, you know, the state is extremely prepared now. They're very afraid of what happened last summer happening again this summer. You know, so that changes the entire terrain of struggle. We can't just go around thinking that, you know, what happened last summer, people can do it in the same way again and get away with it in the same way again. So I think we need to just be a lot smarter and understand the ways that the state has reorganized itself in order to repress us and to prevent more rebellions from happening. So we need to get a lot smarter. And then also, this also creates, we talked about it in the piece that was posted on It's Going Down, oscillations, but we also see these more diffuse or atomized forms of struggle that are also much more illegal and violent and a lot harder for other people to participate in. So a police station got shot up in a Brooklyn Park, you know, which is a neighboring suburb of Brooklyn Center. National Guard soldiers got shot in Minneapolis, that week. In Chicago, there's all these snipings happening. People are sniping cops in Chicago. So we're seeing that dynamic also. We're trying to think about, like, what are the dangers? How do we think about this moving forward?
For sure. Well, that brings us very nicely to our next question. And this is from that piece that you were talking about, and It's Going Down. And I think this is, like, the key question right now. I'm just going to read from it. It says, this leaves the hardest core of militants in a precarious situation. We must carefully assess the situation that's unfolding. It is one thing to riot with thousands of people in the streets throwing down and with the state caught off guard. It is another thing entirely to act the same way with much smaller, less confrontational crowds in a state that has marshaled all its resources in order to repress us. The risk of this argument is to accept passivity, return to meaningless protests, but the inverse scenario is the best fighters get captured and slammed with long prison sentences. And I mean, I feel like this is something we're kind of seeing across the U.S., but especially in like big cities where, people have been like just like going nonstop, like D.C., Portland, Seattle. You know, we saw this in like Hong Kong or Greece where it's sort of like the unwanted children of capital kind of are swept up in this moment, but then kind of the moment either, I don't want to say passes them by, but I mean, you know, Biden's in office now, like there's less people coming out to demos. The police have obviously like learned a lot since last summer, and like, you know, the National Guard is obviously out on the streets. So I'm just curious, you know, like with what you said in mind, like, how do we respond to this situation? Like, what is the answer, if there is one?
Want to go, Shimon?
Sure, okay. Yeah. I mean, there is no clear answer, right? I mean, we're in a moment where another set of comrades at EndNotes wrote a text called Onward Barbarians, and one of the things that they think about is, you know, what happens when you have revolutionaries without a revolution, right? We can think of the Black Liberation Army as revolutionaries without revolution, right? They maintain their fidelity, their commitment to revolution, and they went really hard, and they're amazingly heroic, ethical figures, and yet they, you know, they got demolished by the state and profoundly isolated, you know, and so that's one way to think about the extreme edges of tactics and strategies, which, you know, I think, you know, looking back, it's clear it wasn't the right strategy, right? That strategy did not launch a national uprising against U.S. empire or the U.S. state. So the danger is, okay, if we don't want to do that, then the other danger is, you know, people joining the DSA, people committing, collapsing and saying, you know, fuck it, I'm just going to vote, or giving up, right? My general line is most revolutionaries in the time period that I've been alive or been political since 9/11, don't give up because they're incarcerated or murdered by the state, right? I mean, you know, on average, it's because revolutionaries give up because of demoralization. It's just the system's adaptability and stability just convinces people that revolution is not possible. And I'm sure lots of listeners experienced the beauty and high of last summer. And now, you know, it's reasonable if they're demoralized and feeling like, I mean, you know, I'm fighting those things because now we're back to meaningless, stupid marches with people holding signs, ridiculous academic conferences talking about Black Lives Matter that have nothing to do with the events that occurred last summer. And so, you know, the natural response is to be like, this little phrase that I keep saying in my head was the George Floyd uprising just a dream? You know, we just all dream it. And of course, I know the answer is no, we didn't just dream it. But sometimes it certainly feels like that because the world's ability to go back and pretend that the third precinct, you will not believe how many people, leftists I've talked to, who don't think the burning of the third precinct was this qualitative, transformative event in the last couple decades of struggle. So, you know, I think the dangers are obviously you don't want to expose yourself to, you know, getting thrown in jail when there's not a large sea of people out there, and you don't want to end up giving up either. So there's a set of things that I think revolutionaries need to think about and how to survive if we're in a period of lull, right? I mean, next week there might be a giant uprising and this entire conversation of surviving a period of lull might be really meaningless, right? And I think so we should be careful about that. In one sense, we should still be ready, but at the same time, it does look like the political train has changed a lot. And I could talk more. I'll stop now about what some of the things revolutionaries might do to survive this hopefully short lull, but I'll maybe pass it on to Arturo so I don't end up, you know, talking forever.
It's hard to tell what's going to happen because, yeah, it all depends on how the proletariat decides to move in the immediate future. And, you know, it seems like maybe nothing will happen this summer, but I think we should still prepare as if it could happen tomorrow, which, you know, is a hard kind of crazy position to take. But we need to somehow be ready for a long lull, you know, which might mean just trying to embed ourselves in proletarian neighborhoods where, you know, people were involved in the uprising, try to find those people, build relationships with them. You know, we should be training, we should be studying. We should be trying to also embed ourselves in strategic, like, infrastructure, so, like, workplaces that would be very necessary in the long term for a revolution. So, the, you know, all the industries that are necessary to reproduce life. And, you know, so just agriculture, logistics, energy, sanitation, hospitals. You know, so there's all kinds of long-term work that we need to do. You know, also, you know, the question of the military, you know, like, we saw that the police can be defeated, but, you know, the National Guard kind of puts a limit on how far people are willing to go. So there's a whole question of the National Guard. How do we split the National Guard? What is the stuff that we need to do in the long run to help make that happen? And then, yeah, just, you know, prepare, you know, as much as we can for whatever the future holds.
The only other thing I'd add is, you know, there's probably people listening who... The uprising was their first political event. And, you know, there's lots of people I've met who like that. And I'd say what's been produced is, in my opinion, a new species, you know, in a Fanonian sense. And I, you know, I'm very hostile to people who want to attack young revolutionaries who part, I don't care if these young revolutionaries are white. I don't care if they're black or brown or whoever. And who would attack these young revolutionaries, right? What am I talking about? There's, in my opinion, most of what the left does is perform politics and has little to do with actually transforming anything. And now, for the first time in quite many years, we have a generation of young revolutionaries who leapt off, who dropped their, you know, silly abolish this, abolish that sign, and started doing the deed, right? And to me, that's a fundamental boundary, a division between, you know, the revolutionary abolitionists and the symbolic abolitionists, whatever you want to call them, the reformist abolitionists, the defunders, right? I have nothing but the utmost respect and humility and admiration for all the revolutionary abolitionists out there. And I just hope, you know, that they don't get demolished by this performative left, the symbolic left, all that kind of stuff, and that the new revolutionary abolitionists, you know, sometimes I call them the party of George Floyd. I know party's a bad word, and I'm not using it in a Leninist, you know, word. I'm just using it in a general sense. I don't know, the network of George Floyd, whatever. You know, I hope they take care of themselves and stay away from that performative left, because it will destroy them. It will co-opt them back into holding signs for another 30 years. And dear God, we don't need another 30 years of holding signs while people are still in prisons, kids in cages, etc. You know, so if it isn't clear, I hate the performative left.
Whenever one of these big rebellions pops off, there's a part of my brain that automatically just kind of goes into critical mode and says, like, well, you know, all these riots and, like, the looting, I understand all that, but when is the point going to go where it's going to move from sort of like the riot of the squares to something that begins a process of communization? Some people would point towards, you know, the autonomous zones that were set up, whether this is George Floyd Square or the Chaz or the different things that were kind of, you know, seized during the rebellion that were set up as sort of these like hubs of either mutual aid or sort of kind of like zones where people were launching a lot of stuff from. I'm just curious, you know, in your view, are there signs that this revolt went deeper, or where could it have possibly started to do that from?
Yeah, how to deepen the revolt and shift it from riots and rebellions to insurrections and general strikes, that's like the million-dollar question. And I don't know if we have a blueprint for that, how, you know, how that could happen, but I think you're right that there were glimpses of what that might look like last year, like, you know, the squares, the land occupations that you mentioned. In Philadelphia, there was a Occupy PHA, and there was all these struggles happening around that. you know, and housing occupations and things like that, that converged with the riots. And I would say this, we have to figure out a way for these other forms of struggle to converge with riots. And also not just with housing stuff and like land occupations and stuff like that and squares, but also, you know, we saw glimpses of it with, the transport workers and like bus workers that refused to move and help the police move detained people. I think we saw glimpses of it recently in St. Paul when, organized workers were able to basically convince the National Guard to leave a labor federation center in St. Paul. So that's, you know, that I think splitting the National Guard is a huge question. You know, we saw a little bit of that. We also saw it last year too, where sometimes they refuse to like follow orders and, attack protesters. And, yeah, I mean, and the biggest question, though, I think, is how do workers at strategic points in the mode of production, how do those struggles converge with the riot and the insurrection? I mean, that to me is how an insurrection will happen. But you know, that's a very difficult question. How does the strike converge with the riot?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I'd add, and, you know, it's a slightly different take on, I think everything Arturo's laying out, I certainly agree with, but it's also goes in a slightly different direction, which is, it's not clear. I mean, the mass strikes didn't happen last year. So we have to have a really clear analysis of what were the riots about and what were the limits of the riot? And, you know, so I think Arturo and I have thought a lot about UPS, Worldport, which is this giant, I mean, it's the definitive, processing center for UPS in Louisville. And, you know, that's where Louisville is the place where Breonna Taylor is murdered. And yet there was no meaningful action. You know, I mean, there might have been symbolic actions that we don't know about, but there was no shutting down of Worldport. There was no using the weapon of logistics, and militants or activists of communization have long been thinking about counter logistics as a tool that the proletariat can use. And yet in the United States, it's been a very weak weapon that the proletariat really hasn't used it. That's what I mean. And so I think have to think about, you know, why is it that the black proletariat chooses to riot and not go on these strikes? So there seems to be a clear limit around the division between the riot and strike. There seems to be a limit around what BLM as a concept is able to do when it comes to the strike. It doesn't right go into that mode of action. And finally, you know, and this might be, you know, surprising to listeners, and it's kind of, you know, a little heretical, but I think the reality of it is that the black radical tradition in the workplace encountered many of the problems that the journal Endnotes in their, I think, groundbreaking article, History of Separation, talk about. You know, if the bar is, you know, mass strikes and Soviets or councils, in the United States, black workers were not able to build councils or Soviets, right? One of the most powerful, if not the most powerful weapon that the proletariat has against the bourgeoisie and the capitalist state. So, what we see is that the black working class inside the point of production, is experiencing many of the same limits that white or Latinx or Asian American, workers are experiencing. And that I think that should really help define our analysis of what the riot is able to do, what BLM is able to do, and what the limits of workplace organizing are, which are pretty deep, as History of Separation and Notes article talks about. And I know I gave a very crass and kind of simplistic, if listeners, you know, want to, I could easily nitpick and kind of have an interesting debate. I gave a very crass and simplistic take, but it's something we need to start exploring, and make sense of, because, right, why weren't there mass strikes in the U.S. in the context of BLM? And there's, right, people talk about the fact that there's plenty of black workers, obviously, in the United States, and yet they didn't use that form of weapon, right? I mean, sporadically here and there, but it was very weak compared to the power and dynamism of the riot.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, if I had to take a really strong position, it would be that the strike, the occupations, the squares, splitting of the National Guard, that can only become revolutionary through the process of the riot. And outside of that context, I don't see how it can happen.
You're listening to It's Going Down, part of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. Follow us online at itsgoingdown.org and on Twitter at IGG_news. If you like and appreciate this podcast, go to itsgoingdown.org/shop and give us a one-time donation. Sign up to donate monthly or donate through Bitcoin. Again, that's itsgoingdown.org/shop to support. And now, back to the show. Well, we're going to switch gears here now. Your work and also the notes of other folks like Idris Robinson, we feel, are very important because they draw a clear line that's critical of neoliberal identity politics, but also sees the stark racial reality of settler capitalism. Curious, in your minds, what did the rebellion challenge or expose that we need to expand upon, continuing our struggles and conversations forward in terms of race?
One of the most important things is the overrepresentation of whites in the struggle, in the riots and fighting the police. Obviously I see myself in intellectually part of, I'm not white, but intellectually part of the tradition that says race traitor, that comes from, thinkers like Noel, and others, Noel Ignatieff and others. And what we saw in the George Floyd uprising was exactly that in many ways. And I think we have to have the most clearest accounting of the fact that, that last summer, many whites betrayed their whiteness. And that's what we need, that's central in this country. And, which isn't to take away the fact that the people will be like, oh, are you front, and centering white proletarians? I'm just like, this debate about centering or, whoever it, I'm in the academy. I'm tired of these debates. We need to overthrow this system. And it's very clear whether you read, it's amazing to me. If you read the BLA literature, if you read the Panther literature, if you read, the Ram literature, their orientation around whites is almost you wouldn't recognize it if you saw BIPOC militants talking about white proletarians today. All of them said, if you're white and you're willing to throw down, I'll throw down with you hand in hand, period. And they had a very strategic orientation towards white revolutionaries. Obviously, they were very critical of the white proletariat for its complicity in racism. But at the same time, they recognized that if white proletarians or white revolutionaries joined the struggle, they would happily accept them in that struggle. And it's not clear that most BIPOC revolutionaries have that sense right now. And that's just an astonishing lack of theoretical and strategic clarity, largely because what it's popular to do is to perform kind of a radical performative critique of white people all the time, which will get you some Twitter likes and Instagram likes, but will do absolutely nothing for advancing an actual overthrow of the system. So that's one thing that I think has changed quite a bit.
Yeah. I mean, we got to make it clear that racism, racial oppression, whatever you want to call it, white supremacy is not going to be defeated through white guilt or performative displays of diversity and radicalism. It's not going to be defeated through blindly following whatever POC liberal says in the moment, or through diversity trainings or through, having a diverse group of friends or something like that. Race is going to be overthrown and attacked through people attacking the police, people attacking the prison system, people attacking gentrification, people kicking out bosses from their workplaces. It can only be attacked and dismantled through posing a material physical challenge to the institutions that uphold the racial order. And anything less than that is just it's a kind of reformism. It's this idea that, you can somehow reform these categories without that physical struggle.
One thing I'm curious, your thoughts, and we've talked a lot about this on this show, but I mean, like, since the revolt, it seems like we've had sort of a doubling down on, like, kind of like woke neoliberalism on one side, but then also, like, you have the Tucker Carlson thing on the other that's like, you know, call CPS on, like, parents who are wearing, like, masks outside, or just, like, this, like, weird over-the-top, like, you know, anything that can, like, you know, be a weapon in the culture war, like, use it. Where it's, like, obviously this stuff is just, like, so far removed, I feel like, from most people's day-to-day experience and, like, what they're actually dealing with. We're actually in a good position to, like, articulate something that's, like, outside of both of those things.
I think we are, in some ways, you know, I mean, and so, it's a tough question here. It's a tough set of comments you're saying. It's like, I don't want to be pessimistic about it. I don't want to be overly optimistic about it, because the paradox sometimes seems to me that for all the radicalism of what happened last summer, it's the most conservative forces on the left that seem to capture that energy, quite well, which is very frustrating. We seem to struggle with consolidating our gains and building from moments of strength to strength, you know, and so that's kind of frustrating. I think we're right about, you know, like almost, you know, a lot of things in the world. I don't want to say everything, it's a little arrogant, but I think, you know, the far left is right about tons of stuff in the world. But the dilemma is that the battle of class conflict, although we make some gains, this is a problem of, you know, I think Rosa said it well. I'm gonna mess it up. Every revolution is defeated until the last one, something like that, right? And I think that's kind of true, and I think that's like a very important insight about the type of dynamics we face. And so maybe, you know, it's like we're gonna go from defeat to defeat to defeat until there's a certain kind of rupture that opens up a pathway. The way Russia in 1917 did, for example, it opened up this huge pathway for people to start seeing that, you know, I mean, we all know what happens in Russia, ends up being quite a disaster, but it also opened up a new horizon of struggle for lots of activists and revolutionaries.
Well, I feel that really kind of brings us to the next question, which is that, like, right after Derek Chauvin was sentenced, like, six people were murdered by the police, and we're still seeing protests happen over that, whether it's in North Carolina or it's in Ohio. How do we proceed in this terrain?
I mean, I don't know if there's an answer that, you know, resolves that contradiction, but, you know, I think we should just be doing whatever we can, you know, we should be trying to find the people that we can, you know, who were part of the uprising and the riots, you know, and we should be building relationships with them. We should be trying to consolidate networks out of that. You know, we should be training with these people. We should be studying, you know, we should be trying to develop relationships in these workplaces, you know, and in general, we should just be preparing ourselves for next time that there's an uprising, that we can go a lot harder, we can be a lot smarter, and that we can have more coordination and organization among the partisans of, you know, revolt and revolution. And, you know, that, yes, we might be very isolated for a while. And I don't know if there's a way to avoid that.
Yeah, at the end of the day, I think that's right. And I think the only thing I'll add is, you know, very few people choose revolution as what they want to do or to be a revolutionary. People are forced into those circumstances. And so all the evidence points that there'll be various types of crises unfolding. And what we want to avoid, I think, as serious revolutionaries is become managers of the crisis, right? That's what basically most of the left is about. Their critique isn't that they're against capitalism. Their critique is that they can manage capitalism better than the Democrats or, you know, and certainly the Republicans, right? And I think as revolutionaries, we have no interest in that. What we have an interest in is using crisis as a springboard for revolutionary purposes. And I know some listeners might say, doesn't that sound like Boogaloo Boy accelerationism? You know, bring the Civil War faster and faster. I caution listeners to seed that we cannot seed the terrain of concepts like crisis, civil war, insurrection, right? January 6th, all of a sudden insurrection becomes common language. And now everyone thinks only the right is uses insurrection as a weapon against the system. These are categories and strategies that the proletariat, slaves, peasants have used to fight, you know, capitalism for centuries, settler colonialism for centuries, empire for centuries. And if we concede that, we are dropping some of our most important analytical concepts and tools. And it's also just a reflection that there is really no large revolutionary, quote unquote, left in America. That mostly what people consider themselves leftists are really just aspiring state managers, right? No matter their rhetoric, and they'll have nice, you know, they'll have all kinds of performative aspects. What they really want to be is president and run the country better for capitalism. That's crude, but I think very true. And we should look at the upcoming crises as opportunities to continue to see if revolution is on the horizon, because that they're inseparable. Name me a revolution that's occurred without crisis. I can't really think of anything.
Just to kind of go back to something that you said earlier before, you said consolidating our gains. And I think this is something that has come up time and time again in recent discussions we've had on this show. What does that look like?
You know, I'll just say, you know, and I guess I'm more on the, like, on the organizational tip. It's like, you know, we need to build these forms of organization and coordination among the partisans of revolt. And we need to find the people that we were running around with last summer, you know, that were complete strangers and we had no way of staying in touch with them. And, you know, we need to somehow build some form of coordination among, you know, what we're calling the George Floyd left. Or, you know, this new species. You know, we need to find each other. We need to train. We need to organize.
Yeah, I mean, it's tempting. I mean, since we're returning back to this question, I can just add, you know, there's like simple maxims, you know, that we might want to try to live by in this period. You know, some that I think are important is be careful of the internet, right? I mean, the internet is some of the worst of discourse that occurs, and don't let that shape our the relationships we build with comrades. I think it's important that after another one is after the uprising, we should write for each other, right? Writing for each other is a way of finding our friends, finding the partisans, right? You're in Los Angeles. I don't know who you are, but if you throw up a blog, I can be like, oh, there's these people in Los Angeles who are thinking about this. Obviously be mindful of security culture, right? I'll say one more is be mindful of your capacities in a period of lull. You know, we just, when you're involved in struggle, lots of parts of your life fall apart. Lots of parts come together because struggles are beautiful, but lots of them fall apart. You spend too much money. You get hurt. You get emotionally, you know, messed up. Use this time to heal, not only on your own, but together with the new friends you found, right? So there's a whole set of things that I think comrades can do in this period that can build resiliency and strength. Those are only some, but there's many more, without turning to reformism or without turning to, you know, kind of a, whether it's Weather Underground or BLA strategy, you know, of just like, we're going to have to go hard and never give up. We should go hard and never give up, but we should pay attention to how the proletariat broadly is navigating the moment. And right now the proletariat is a little bit off the streets, which changes the terrain for us.
What has the rebellion challenged in terms of your previously held ideas, and what has it solidified?
For me, it's just that revolution is possible, and it's a real possibility moving forward. And that, you know, a lot of regular people that had nothing to do with the left, nothing to do with established leftist subcultures or organization, really, truly think that. I was totally caught off guard. I didn't think that there would be an uprising last year.
Yeah, I mean, for me, oddly enough, you know, I wrote a dissertation a while ago about the complete defeat of the Black radical tradition in the 1970s. And the uprising forced me to reevaluate that there's a particular form, right? To me, the Black radical tradition, I want to be very clear, is illegality, insurrections, illegal strikes, riots, armed struggle, things of that sort. And because of the academic subsumption of the Black radical tradition, most of that just got lost in the last 30, 40 years. I mean, you wouldn't know those forms of activities half the time if you read the scholarship in the Black radical tradition. And so for me, the proletariat literally, not only the Black proletariat, the proletariat saved the tradition for me because it had been so mangled and deformed by the academic inheritors of the Black radical tradition that, you know, it was the proletariat that taught me once again what the Black radical tradition was. Yeah, so that was a major intellectual leap for myself because I thought the tradition was wiped out in the 1970s.
Can people follow your work anywhere? Do you want to give any shout outs? Anything you're working on? I really want to just thank you all for taking the time to talk with us for so long. And anything you want to plug?
I'll plug, you know, a lot of Arturo and I's writing is found on illwill.com. You should check that out. Obviously, IGD, we write posts for you all. And then we have a book that came out through Daraja Press called The Revolutionary Meaning of the George Floyd Uprising. You can buy it through Daraja or Amazon or, you know, all that kind of stuff. Or, you know, they have a free PDF on Daraja Press, too, if you just want to get the free PDF. Arturo, is there anything else?
Yeah, I guess I would just say there's an Instagram. We have an Instagram. We're trying to do the whole social media thing, thinking about memes and all that. So there's an Instagram, fragments.215, if anybody wants, to link up.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.